Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties, bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent ones, are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. Now this time we're going to talk about egos and controlling our ego and controlling the egos of our participants in order to reach a successful conclusion, in order to prevent, well, a clash, as they say. So, as we often do, I think what we're going to do first is define what we're talking about. So, in a basic, non-Freudian, detailed type way, because I know that there's whole psychoanalysis that goes with the word ego, in kind of a basic way, when we talk about controlling our ego and controlling the ego of others, what are we talking about? How should we define the ego and what it is that we're really saying when we talk about controlling it? And I see we already have lots of participation. Thank you all for being here. I love having you. And let's see about these definitions that we've gotten. Risha says that the ego is an idea of one's own worth. An idea of one's own worth. Good point. That certainly is an idea of one's own worth. And people are saying that it's oftentimes an inflated idea. Sometimes. But maybe you have really good self-esteem and you think that you're worth quite a lot, and it might be true. Marcella says it's a sense of self-importance. A sense of self-importance. That goes with own worth, doesn't it? Sense of self-importance. Let's see. Tina and others are saying that the ego is when you're concerned with your own self-interest. Concerned with your own self-interest. That goes with self-importance and with an idea of one's own worth. All of these are self-interest type things, aren't they? Now, here's a word that's being used quite a bit, and thank you for all of your participation. Don and others are saying that the ego is the same, is synonymous with pomposity. That's kind of inflated self-worth, isn't it? Pomposity. Good point that Don is making a point that it's more than just inflated self-worth. It's letting everyone know about your inflated self-worth. It's kind of like, well, it's public inflated self-worth. Yeah, pomposity. And Shaylee and others are saying that when you have a very advanced ego, you have an emphasis on your own achievements. An emphasis on your own achievements. Now let's think about this. The definitions of ego have kind of divided. These were the ones basically that were, well, less than flattering perhaps. A little bit less than flattering, you think? Kind of a sense of self-worth. I guess they're not unflattering, but they kind of imply a little bit of a negative connotation, especially the word pomposity, yeah? So what about an emphasis on the positive? And quite a few people are giving a positive definition of the ego. Cheryl says that your ego is your positive self-image. Yeah. What do you think yourself, your positive self-image. And I suppose it could be a negative one too, but that would not be, that would be, well, I guess it would be a deflated ego, come to think of it. Yeah, your positive self-image. And Lynn and others are saying that you need a strong ego to be a confident leader. So it's a positive thing. You need to have strong self-image and self-esteem and a sense of one's self-importance and worth in order to be a good leader. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very valid point, that if you lack confidence, that you lack a sense of yourself and about your worth and your ability and your achievements, you're probably not going to be a really good leader because people won't want to follow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Didn't think about it that way. And Roberto and others are saying that an ego is neither positive nor negative. An ego is self-awareness. Ooh, nicely done, Roberto. Ego is neither positive nor negative. It is self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And it can go both ways, but it's self-awareness. It's not necessarily either positive or negative. Very, very good idea. Mm-hmm. So, now that we've defined the ego and what we're talking about, let's ask the next logical question that people are indeed asking, and this is a practical show. So we ask practical questions. When does the ego need control? Mm-hmm. When should we rein it in? When should we consciously think, well, I think maybe we should have another think about this, and we should exercise some, well, self-control, control over the group. But let's do self-control first, really. And Parker says that the ego needs control when you feel that you're more important than anyone else. I think that's a real good rule of thumb, that you need to kind of control your ego when you feel that you're more important than anyone else. Very good point, because, well, everyone has value in the group. You're maybe different, but we're not more important, really, even if we're the leader, right? Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people using the term know-it-all. And, of course, this is a global show, and I think that may be an Americanism. But it means that somebody who knows everything and therefore can't be taught anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are saying it goes with pomposity. And, yes, a pompous person is a know-it-all. And Carolyn says that when you need to control your ego, when there's refusal to listen because you're a know-it-all. Mm-hmm. Refusal to listen. Yeah, know-it-alls never listen to anyone else because they're so certain that they are right. And they know all the different solutions and all the different issues, and they've got it. There we go. Don't have to listen to anyone else because I know it all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jose and others are saying that we need to control the ego, to control ours and participants too, when the ego leads to arrogance. You need to control your ego when the ego is leading you to arrogance. That's I know it all and I'm better than anyone else. There we go. Mm-hmm. You know, the point is being made of that people are talking about self-esteem. And I rather agree with this. Brian says that that you need to remember that high self-esteem is not egotism. You can have high self-esteem and still value other opinions. And that's the key to it. Mm-hmm. Because as a leader, you have high self-esteem. You're held in high regard by other people, right? Mm-hmm. But the key is not to become an egotist, not to be so impressed with yourself that you don't value anyone else's opinion, only you. Mm-hmm. So you need to remember this, as Brian says, that high self-esteem is not egotism. You can have high self-esteem and still value other opinions. In fact, if you have high self-esteem, you very much value other opinions because you're not scared of anybody else being smart. You ever be in a group where the leader, the person in charge or someone else doesn't like to hear other opinions because they're scared that they'll be better than theirs? Mm-hmm. because they really have low self-esteem, and they're afraid that if someone else has an opinion or comes up with a plan or a solution, that somehow it will take away from them, or they might lose their job or their position or something like that. And therefore, they are afraid to have opinions be brought forward that they didn't think about, that they didn't think on. And therefore, they try to bluster their way and prevent other people's opinions from being valued. Mm-hmm. See, high self-esteem, that's kind of an egotistical. It may be even low self-esteem, which is rather the opposite of egotistical, right? But the outcome's the same. They don't want to hear other opinions. And if you have high self-esteem but you're not egotistical, you listen to everybody's opinions. Right. Good idea. Mm-hmm. So, now we've rather talked about ourselves. We've talked about our egos. And what we should do about it and what we should watch for and what it means to have an ego that's being kind of disruptive. So when do the participant egos need to be under control? Because we can gain self-control of ourselves, right? We can remind ourselves that we're not better than other people and to listen and to value other people's opinions. We can do those things within ourselves to make us better listeners, to make us better negotiators, to make us better teachers and lecturers and third-party impartials and whatever it is we're doing. Listening is a wonderful skill. And listening with an open mind and allowing others to have an opinion too, because we don't know it all. Can't possibly. We're only humans. Mm-hmm. So when does the participant ego need control? When do we have to say stop? This is getting out of hand. Mm-hmm. And Uma says, and others are saying, that you need to get the participants under control when they clash because everyone insists that they are right. They're all know-it-alls. Have you ever been in a room like that? Everybody's a know-it-all. They know everything, and they're all correct. Except that's not the way we're going to get consensus, right? To all be astonishingly correct. See? And that's when they need to keep their egos in control, and we need to help them. When they clash because everyone insists that they are right, when the egos clash. Good point. Hollis is making a good point, too. She says that when self-importance prevents compliance is when you know that you need to control the egos in the room. When self-importance prevents compliance. Good point, Hollis. Nicely put. Oh, and here's a corollary to it, which is very, very true. Paul says that you need to control the egos in the room when self-importance prevents listening. Prevents listening, which is the most important thing. You have to be able to listen to what the other people think, to their opinions, and to consider them as a group. And not saying, well, no, we're going to do it this way. It's going to take 20 minutes, and that's what we're going to do. The issues are more complex than that because there are humans involved. Right. So what else? When self-importance prevents listening. You know, this is an interesting point that I didn't think about under ego, but it's being made by quite a few people, and thank you for all of your participation. And I always say that these shows are not scripted. They actually are kind of organic. They grow with the questions. And I often learn something that I didn't think about, and I hope you do too. You know, Noelle and a few others are saying that you need to control the egos in the room when the participants have made promises they cannot keep. When the participants have made promises they cannot keep. You know, sometimes in prior shows I say, and by the way, if you'd like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent ones, archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com /recipeforpeace now. There we go. And we've talked about the fact that whenever you've got a room full of participants, even if you're doing this, I do a lot of seminars and workshops, and I do, of course, a lot of mediation, but especially when the issues are contested, like in a mediation or in a compliance hearing or something like that, when you really need to be able to work together, you have to remember that you're looking at four people, say, however many people are in the room. But those people have done what Noel says: when participants have made promises they can't keep is when the egos need control. Because a lot of times there's more than those four people in the room because they need to report back to someone. And what do they need to report back if we've had an alternative dispute resolution and we need to resolve something? Yes, thank you. Thank you for your participation. A lot of people know exactly the answer because we've been together a while and you've come again. Thank you. The main thing that you need to know is that the people in the room have to report back to their people that sent them, to their superiors, to somebody. And what do they have to report back? That they won. Yes, that's all they want to report back. They want to report back that they won. They want to report back the adventure of winning. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's when they've made promises that they must be allowed to keep by making it a win-win situation, so that when they describe what happened and what the outcome was and that we successfully reached our group goal, the people who are listening, the people who sent them or are interested in what they are doing, will be impressed. Yes, because they kept their promise to effectuate change, for example. Yeah, and they won. They got it. Mm-hmm. Well, participants have made promises they can't keep. Interesting thing to keep in the back of your mind, that's what has happened, that there's others involved, the great, mysterious, invisible other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Frank says that you need to control the participant egos when they refuse to acknowledge another solution. When they refuse to acknowledge another solution, we know what's going to happen. We know what the proper course is. We don't need to talk about anything else, even though the world is moving very rapidly and there may have been some sort of, I don't know, technological advance or something we need to talk about. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're done. We've got it handled. Mm-hmm. Refuse to acknowledge another solution. We've got our mind set up. We've got it made up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, this is a practical show, a practical program, and we always think about not just the theory of what it looks like, but what we should do about it. So I think that the thing that we're going to talk about now, the issue that we're going to talk about now, is what should we do to mitigate an impasse caused by refusal to control the egos in the room? It's happened. They've had a clash. They are feeling kind of stubborn. And everybody needs to win because they're reporting back to someone. And what should we do about it? Mm-hmm. What should we do when the personalities really, really clash and they get into an ego fight? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good point Ray and others are making. That when you see that, when you need to mitigate the harm because we've gotten that far and you can't actually throw somebody out of the room. Ray and others are saying that the best thing to do is to call in a third party impartial. What a good idea. Somebody whose ego is out of the equation. They're the third party impartial. It does not have to be an attorney. People think a mediator always has to be an attorney. There are lots of mediators who are not attorneys. And it doesn't even have to be somebody who is technically a mediator. It's somebody who truly is impartial, doesn't care which way it goes, and can get the sides to see reason. Mm-hmm. Can reason with them. When I'm a third-party impartial, which I frequently am, and we've got an impasse going, I divide up the parties, and they're attorneys usually, and take them into separate rooms, and we talk about it, what they really, really, really want. And if it's a big enough issue and there are attorneys, I ask for a statement paper beforehand. I ask so I can know what the different issues are and how which side feels what about them. Mm-hmm. But I'm the third party impartial. I can do that. Yeah. I can demand that people put their issues down on paper, for example. Two reasons. It crystallizes them. If something's silly and dumb, it doesn't get there. Or if it does, I can throw it out. And it gives me the third-party impartial knowledge so that I can help the parties. Yeah. Third party. It's a wonderful idea, not only because the attorneys get money. No. It's a wonderful idea because it will prevent the sides from fighting with the leader. He or she can kind of be the referee of the whole thing. Maya and others are saying that in order to mitigate an impasse caused by refusal to control the egos in the room, that you can call in an expert to present reasonable evidence and render an opinion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can call in an expert to present reasonable evidence and research and to have an opinion, to give an expert opinion. Because the parties are not getting along perhaps as smoothly as they could, you call in a third party who has no real interest except to tell the truth. This is a good thing. Yeah, call in an expert. It's kind of like calling a third party impartial. A lot of times the third party impartial is an expert in negotiation tactics, if nothing else. Yeah. Devin says that in order to break the impasse, you should assign teams to research the issues and report back to the group. Yeah, make them go out and get third-party impartial information. Make them research it. You can have different teams may come up with different results. But then we can look at all of it. And we can see because people want to look up to research something that validates their opinion, right? Right. So everybody comes in with different research, and we can use all of it so that we know what we're doing. And if we need to call in an expert, who that expert might be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is my favorite one primarily because, of course, it is something that Recipe for Peace Now advocates very greatly. Barbara and others are saying that when you reach an impasse like that because you have an egotistical clash, that it's time for a timeout. Mm-hmm. It is. A little bit of a break from sitting formally around the room and negotiating. Time for a timeout. Time to have a little bit of a breather, as they say. And, oh, that's an Americanism. Two people go, no, it's an Americanism. Yep, you're right. It just means a timeout, a time to really to regroup and not sit in the same position, in the same chair, and be constantly at business. So we're going to call a timeout because it eases the friction between the parties. It eases the friction between the egos. And if we're not all sitting together like that and negotiating seriously, strictly, the third party impartial can go around to all the parties and help them to be reasonable when we get back to the table. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good thing third party impartial is a good person to go around the group. I do it all the time when we've got kind of issues between us. Mm-hmm. So, we have reached the potluck portion, the food portion of our show. How exciting. And, you know, the timeout's an excellent segue because if you have a timeout or you need to take a break and you let people leave the room, They will use their cell phone and call someone worse than they are. They will lose their train of thought, or their plane will wander off. No, we want to keep them interested and excited and enthusiastic and in the same room. And the best way to do that, no. Thank you for all of your participation. Quite a few men, I think, are putting the word duct tape in here. No, you cannot duct tape your participants to the chairs. We're going to do something a lot nicer. We're going to feed them. We're going to have food in the room. And I always say a potluck is fun, a potluck being where you bring, everybody brings something, because it inherently gives you something to talk about. That looks delicious. It smells wonderful. What's it called? How was it made? How'd you learn to do that? You see, these are all questions that people adore answering, and it leads to connectiveness and a good group dynamic. So, we're going to have some food and keep everybody together and working. Before, and I know that I say this each time, and you can prove it by going back to the website, recipeforpeacenow.com, looking at the most recent shows. Every time I say this, but it's so important that I'm going to say it again. Yes, yes. If you're going to have food of any sort, you will take a survey amongst your participants, however it is that you're doing it, email, whatever, and you will ask if anyone has a food prohibition, dietary, religious, just a preference with something they won't eat, an allergy, and you will respect it, and you will put this around to everybody. Because this is a good time and a convivial atmosphere, and we do not want to make anyone sick or hurt or excited. Yeah, they want to have, we want them to have a good time. Mm-hmm. And also, this is really just, it's not only a good idea, but also I hate to run out of food. It makes for a bad party, right? I think the leader should bring extra food. And amongst that extra food, just in case someone forgets, you know how that is, or brings a really small amount. And the extra food, at least one of the dishes should be a safe dish. Now, what on earth does that mean? What's a safe dish? Well, it doesn't have too many ingredients. It's not something that will cause a bad reaction for many of the participants, at least not that we know of. Pardon me, and the ingredients would be known to your participants, and they would have eaten them before. Now, I happen to be in the United States, so my ingredients may not be as safe in your country, because this is a global show. But that's the idea, something that everybody can eat. Mm-hmm. Also, if you're going to bring food, thank you. Quite a few of you are going, you haven't said list yet, and you're heading towards the recipe. Thank you. You're absolutely right. I didn't say it yet. The other thing I always say, which is very important, when you have food, you need to ask people to label the food. Not what is it called, meatloaf, but what is in it, so that we can run our eye down the list and see if we can eat that. Whatever that is. Yes, very important to label everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if it comes in a package, you just leave the package out so that everybody can read the label. There you go. Yeah. I don't really, you know, a lot of times potlucks, people bring wonderful homemade things, and then sometimes some people don't. And sometimes they bring something packaged. And, you know, that's not a bad thing, really, as long as they bring enough. But they could leave the container out. Mm-hmm. So our safe recipe is going to be spinach rice. This is actually delicious, and it's very good looking. It's very attractive, mm-hmm, with the green and the white and the onions and like that. Now, I'm going to give a very straightforward recipe where you actually make the rice for this dish. And I'm going to confess something that probably I shouldn't, but I'm going to do it anyway. I have a rice cooker. Those of you who have been to my events, a workshop, a seminar, a mediation, know that I serve rice a lot on the side, and I have a rice cooker. It's one of the few things I own that doesn't do more than that one thing, make rice. But to tell you the truth, I do it so often and it's so convenient that it's an all right thing. Mm-hmm. So I have rice left over. Now, I disapprove of making leftovers after like one day because you don't want to make anybody sick. But if you've got rice left over and you've refrigerated it, you could kind of use it in this recipe. So that it gets used up. You would heat it, of course, so you put it in the refrigerator overnight or whatever. And, yeah, it's a really nice recipe to use if you've got, how shall I put this delicately, quite a bit of rice left over. So, but let's do it the straight way, the regular way. And the answer to how much cooked rice, at least 3 cups, probably more than that. You mix it in with the spinach and you decide how much you'd like. So let's do it the straight way. And we're going to say that we're making the rice, but really this is a wonderful recipe for extra rice, especially if you're doing something like the next day, because I don't like to keep anything too long. So we're going to have 4 pats of butter, about 1 ounce each. Nice size. And a lot of times, at least in the States, the wrapping is marked off in measurements. So 4 of those. And then we're going to have 1 cup of rice. If you like long grain or white or whatever it is you like, the brownish whole grain type rices make it nice and nutty in flavor. Let's have 2 cups of vegetable stock. We might as well keep this vegetarian. 2 tablespoons of oil. I like a lot of onion in it, and we are going to saute them, so it's not going to be real strong. Let's have 2 nice big onions that we're going to chop up. In medium chop, doesn't have to be minced, right? Now, if you want to go to the market and get real spinach, the fresh kind, your spinach rice will be better than mine. But personally, I am going to use one of those 10-ounce or so frozen chopped spinaches. Get it in the freezer aisle. You need to thaw it very thoroughly. Remember to thaw it. And I think it comes out just as well, and it's delicious, and it's the convenience factor. So let's have 1 10-ounce chopped spinach that we are going to defrost. It comes in the freezer. We're going to defrost it, and we're going to wick off any of the water. And you know what? If you like onions, you can put some scallions in here. I don't usually. Some people are allergic to scallions, or else they just won't eat them. So we've got our rice made. If we used it from perhaps yesterday, or we just this instant made it, we've got our rice all nicely made, and it's all warm and fluffy, and it's delightful, right? Right. You make it off the package, whatever the package says. Basically speaking, you bring it to a boil, you reduce the heat, and you cover it for about 20 minutes so that the water gets absorbed. Okay, that's been done. So we're going to take our oil, we're going to heat it in a nice pan, and we're going to add the onion, and we're going to stir it around until it gets translucent and it smells really nice. Then we're going to add the spinach, which we did drain. Did I mention the draining part? The frozen stuff needs to be thawed and patted dry real thoroughly, really drained. So we're going to add our onion, cook it. There we go. We're going to add the spinach, reduce the heat, and cover it and simmer. It's got the onions. It's got the spinach. It's got all kinds of delicious things. Let it sit there and simmer. Yeah. We're going to add this. Did I say to add the spinach? Reduce the heat, simmer it. What we're doing is we're heating the spinach through. Are we going to use scallions? If we are, and we're going to take a little bunch of scallions, about 4 or 5 of them, and we chopped up, add them now. Remember that rice, if it was left over, of course, we warmed it, right? It's not cold anymore. And we're going to add our spinach mixture to our rice, and we're going to stir it real thoroughly. It's going to look pretty because it's going to be with the green and the white, and it's going to be delicious. It's got the sautéed onions, and it's got quite a bit of spinach and a little bit of butter to make it all good. Yes, please do not use a substitute thing. Thank you for your participation, but a lot of people are asking about margarine and things. It kind of needs the butter. It's not that much butter in the scheme of things, and it gives it a delightful taste. And if you are using new rice, you know, the cup of rice, you can indeed brown it in a little bit of the oil ahead of time and then add the water and boil it if you like. It gets a little bit of nutty. I personally like the wild rice better because it tastes better and it's a little firmer. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, when I get it out of the rice cooker, usually it's white rice. I got to admit that. And it looks pretty. Looks pretty with the spinach. And you've got to remember to thaw the spinach, of course. Yeah. People are asking how much frozen spinach. A package worth it comes in a package about 10 ounces, 10, 12 ounces. Yeah. It comes frozen in the States. A lot of places it does. Mm-hmm. So we just add everything together. Then you add after you've stir-fried the onions. You add the onions, just you add the spinach, you reduce it, you simmer it for a little while, just because everything needs to get hot. And you do it, you don't burn the pot, you do it until the spinach is hot. And then you mix it with the rice. There you go. It's delightful. People really like it. Go, oh, how'd you make that? Oh, it was very complicated. Oh, well, all right. It wasn't really complicated at all, now, was it? So that's our safe recipe. It's safe because there's nothing in it that your participants probably haven't eaten before, and they know that they can. And we made it vegetarian, of course, because we had the vegetable stock. You know, we had 2 cups of the vegetable stock, and that is a really good way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so now we've got what's our adventure recipe? Our adventure recipe is a pasta with bolognese sauce. Delicious. Why is it an adventure recipe? Because I am using sausage instead of ground meat. You want to make it less adventurous, use ground meat. And I am using wine to flavor it. It gives it an extra dimension. You don't want to use wine, use beef stock, beef broth, instead of the wine. But you need a little bit of liquid. So, but we're going to do it the adventurous way. A lot of people do not eat pork, and sausage is, of course, pork. Okay. Well, all right, there is such a thing as beef sausage. People call it meat sausage. Yeah, but basically, most of them are pork. Okay. So, we're going to have about 1 pound of pasta, which we're going to cook al dente and drain and set aside. Mm-hmm. And the trick is that I do not like to use long, stringy pieces of pasta. Those of you who have been here before know this, because it's too messy. It's too messy to serve. It's too messy to get on the plate. It's too messy to eat. I like a penne or a rigatoni or something that is pieces that you can spoon out. Mm-hmm. We had 1 pound of the pasta. Let's have 1 pound of nice Italian sausage. Mm-hmm. Delicious. And we're going to, if they're in a heavy casing, we're going to pull them out of the casing because we're going to stir them into the pot and we're going to cook them and make it all brown and delicious and like that. And so we need to get rid of the casing. Mm-hmm. Let's have a nice big onion that we're going to chop. 3 carrots that we're going to finely chop so that they don't look like big pieces of carrots. And let's have 1 red pepper that we're going to chop also. And, of course, we need to devein and de-seed the red pepper. 4 cloves of garlic. We're going to mince them up. People say I use a lot of garlic. You think that's a true statement, then use less. These are all suggestions, of course. Now, if you are going to use fresh tomatoes, get 2 pounds and seed and chop them. You need about, 4 cups of them when you get all done. I personally, and we all know this, am going to use 2 large cans of diced tomatoes. It's easy for me to get. It's a real time saver. It's very, very cheap, and it's very accessible to me. You use fresh, yours will be better than mine. But I'm going to use, they're about 14 ounces. I'm going to use 2 nice regular-sized cans of diced tomatoes. Might as well use the diced ones so you don't have to chop them. And we're going to use the juice, too. If you use fresh tomatoes, you might need a little bit more liquid. You have to look at it. Let's have a 6-ounce can of tomato paste. 3/4 of a cup of a nice red wine. This is where you can use beef broth if you want to make it more of a safe recipe. I think the wine adds an extra dimension. Please do not cook with wine that you wouldn't under any circumstances drink, because it doesn't have a good taste to it, right? Right. If it's bitter and funny, you don't want to drink it. You don't want to put it in your cooking. No, that would be a bad idea. So make passable wine. It doesn't have to be expensive wine, but it should be something that has a nice taste and not spoiled for sure. Let's have about a teaspoon of dried basil that we're going to crush up, and a teaspoon of dried oregano. There is such a thing called Italian seasonings, at least there is here. It is kind of a mixture of all kinds of nice Italian seasonings. It's quite delicious, and if you can get it, that's actually what I would use. I would use a couple of teaspoons, which would be a tablespoon, right, of the Italian seasoning spices, the kind of mixture. But it's basically basil and oregano, let's face it. And you know what? We're going to use a little bit of whipping cream, just like a quarter of a cup when we get all done, because it smooths out the sauce. And it's just delicious. It's kind of my secret thing, to use the little bit of cream. I've always done it. My grandmother taught me to, and it is smooths out the sauce. Very, very nice. Mm-hmm. And please do not substitute something less fattening, like milk, because it won't work. You got to have the thick stuff. So we've got all these nice ingredients. We've cooked our pasta, and now we're going to get ourselves a nice pot. We took the pasta aside, of course, and we're going to uncase the sausage, and we're going to, that has oil and fat in it, so we don't need to have oil particularly in the pot. If you think you do, add a little bit, and we're going to cook the sausage and the onion and the carrot and the pepper and the garlic. We're going to put it all in. We're going to cook it all around until the meat is brown and the onion is soft and everything is combined. And it smells really nice because you've got the garlic in there. Right, yeah. And it's going to be all translucent. The onions are going to be translucent. The meat's going to be cooked. Now we're going to stir in our tomatoes with the juice, well, yeah, this kind of juice from the can. Our tomato paste, which we're going to make sure actually gets incorporated. The wine. The herbs that you're using, whichever kind you do it. And we now are getting to be sauce, right? We're going to take this whole thing. It's all incorporated. We're going to bring it to boiling, because you have to bring it to boiling before you can simmer it. High heat, then low heat. And I like to do it uncovered for a little bit and then cover it. And you need to stir it occasionally. Not constantly, because you've got it covered and you want it to simmer and kind of incorporate, but you don't want it to stick either. When you've got sauce and you know it because it's nice and thick and all incorporated, that's when you stir in the whipping cream at the last minute and kind of just heat it through. You just stir it in at the last minute. Mm-hmm. You remember that nice pasta that we had? We're going to reheat it because it's probably gotten cold. And we are going to put our sauce over it and stir it all together. Delicious. Very, very popular. Mm-hmm. Everybody likes the meat sauce. You want to make it less adventurous. No wine, no sausage. Beef and beef broth will do it also, because you've got the liquid. So that is our adventure recipe. Adventure because of the pork and because of the wine. Yes. And I see that our time together is nearly up. Yes. And we had a lovely discussion about controlling our egos, which, of course, is what we're going to be able to do, and controlling the egos of our participants. Yes, I can talk. This is all good. And in order to reach consensus, in order to be able to compromise, which is, of course, the most important part. Mm-hmm. So, and I want to thank you for all of your participation. I hope that you learned something. I always learn something during these shows, and I hope you did too. Mm-hmm. And thank you for being here. Thank you for your participation. If you'd like to contact us, we're at hello, recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. If you would like to visit our website, we're at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Prior shows, the last five, the most recent five, including this one, just as soon as we get off the air, are going to be archived on our website at recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. And thank you for all of your participation. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.